You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. A-list celebrity cover girls, retail presence both in print and online, and giving the woman on the move exactly what she wants, without risking editorial quality or journalistic integrity. We take a look at one of the year's biggest fashion launches. On The Stack this week, we sit down with the woman behind the look and feel of one of the print industry's biggest new arrivals, fashion title Porter magazine. Its fashion director warned us here on The Stack last year that something big was coming. Well, it certainly did. And with the distribution in 60 markets in 220 cities, Porter certainly kicked off with a bang earlier this year. We'll be talking about how it's going and getting some fresh insights. We'll also be keeping abreast with latest developments in independent retailing and staying in the UK, but not London, in Nottingham, in fact, where one man is on a mission to change the magazine buying experience.
The key thing is to create an environment that they want to spend time in and start to build a community that they want to be a part of.
All that and plenty more besides is ahead on this 86th edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London for this edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Today we're very lucky to be joined by Gabrielle Hackworthy, who's fashion director of Porter magazine, which was launched by the online luxury retailer Net-a-Porter in February this year. Gabrielle Hackworthy, welcome back to The Stack.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
We always love to have you on the programme. And, well, there's only really, of course, one place to start. We've got to talk about Porter magazine. I guess my opening gambit is simply, how is it all going?
It's going very well. We've had such a huge launch. We launched during New York Fashion Week in February, and we literally took the town over. We were on every billboard. We had cabs advertising the site. We launched an app called I Am Porter, which thousands of people downloaded and created their own Porter covers with their own image. The best news is that on the newsstand, it's been selling out in countries like Australia because we've got a global newsstand distribution in over 60 countries worldwide. And for us, that's the most gratifying thing. It's great when the industry gets behind it, and the reception from the fashion industry has been overwhelming from advertisers and designers and our peers. But actually, who we want to really appeal to is the reader.
Absolutely. The reader. We should always remember that it's at the heart of all of this. Let me ask you a bit about the sort of background to this, because obviously not coming from a sort of an established publishing house per se, but from this different sort of genesis. I mean, what were the specific kinds of challenges, or did actually you and the team, I mean, I guess that maybe is fairly liberating because there aren't the same maybe confines or parameters, or were there challenges that perhaps, you know, at 2 a.m. when you're battling with things, you thought, this was a terrible idea after all.
Yes. I think the challenges are we essentially set up a publishing house within a retail company. And, you know, and they're two very different businesses. So it was a real education process from the, you know, the publishing team to the retail team and vice versa. For the editorial team, we had a lot to learn in terms of the digital side of the magazine because we have a digital edition and there's an e-commerce platform that sits alongside the print edition. So that was the real learning curve from the editorial side. From the retail side, they just had no idea what we were doing, really. So we...
In a good way or a bad way?
In a good way, because they had no... experience with the way a magazine is, you know, formed and run and what kind of infrastructure we needed. So even simple things like I turned up one day and said, oh, so where's my fashion cupboard? And they're like, oh, why do you need a fashion cupboard? And I was like, well, because we need to put clothes, the samples. They said, aren't you going to get the samples from the site? And I said, no, we're using samples that don't exist anywhere other than, you know, from designer showrooms. And they were like, oh, so, you know, things like that, they hadn't really factored in. So it was a bit of an education process, but we got there in the end.
Now, it's interesting, you mentioned obviously these sort of digital expressions of the business, and this is coming from a company that's very much in the sort of vanguard of fashion in that digital arena. I'm sure it's a question that you and your colleagues are absolutely sick to the back teeth of. However, that will not stop me from asking it anyway. Why print? I mean, fundamentally, it seems to buck certain trends within certain parts of that business. Why is it so important, so fundamental to the overall vision, do you think?
Well, the reason we decided to go in print was because there was a demand from our customers. We did a lot of research before we launched Porter, and one of the questions we asked, the Net-a-Porter woman was, how many magazines do you read? And they were all reading between 3 and 8 editions a month, and they were reading global editions. So from that, we sort of understood that there was a real appetite for print for a woman of a certain age, of a certain net worth, who we were targeting. So, and for them, it was a real luxury, and it was something that they, you know, reading fashion magazines is what they do to unwind at the end of the day. So there was a demand for it, and that's why we decided to launch.
Now, one of my favourite games I always play is to leaf through, of course, 2 sort of mastheads and play a kind of masthead bingo and see, you know, who's doing what and figure out how all of these different elements fit together. And there's obviously a very big team, varied backgrounds, lots of experiences. How did that all work? Because I think people often look and say, right, well, okay, the editor, they're in charge, and then this person does these things. Was there that sort of delineation, or because of this interesting genesis that you've been describing, was it a sort of really creative, exciting free-for-all in terms of how everyone sort of connected together?
I think, you know, in terms of a magazine, we're still following a very traditional print format in terms of the staffing. And, you know, we have an editor-in-chief, we have a features director, we have a fashion director, myself. So everyone has a section of the magazine that they are responsible for, and then the editor-in-chief obviously oversees everything. So it's not unusual in that respect. There is a whole digital side, a digital team that, and a social media team that maybe other magazines don't have as many of, but no, it's a pretty traditional setup.
And what about the engagement then with the sort of the business that's at the core, the business that's behind this? Because I'm sure that the magazine editorially is independent in terms of sharing its vision. But what is the sort of role that Natalie herself, for example, plays? Is there a lot of liaison? How does that relationship work? Because I guess that is sort of fundamental to the overall success of the whole project.
I mean, Natalie is such a great and inspiring woman, and she really is very much part of the editorial team, more as a sounding board, really. I mean, she's not involved in the day-to-day, but we feel like she is the Porter woman, and if she has an opinion, we'll listen to it. And she's got amazing ideas because she comes from an editorial background. She started at W Magazine and then went to Tatler. So her work history is based in editorial, and she very much carries that work outlook through to the Net-a-Porter site. And then she's very involved with Porter because she's got great ideas.
Mm. Now, let's talk a little bit about the sort of the style, I guess, the sort of overall editorial, you know, the creative, the sort of design appearance and the editorial direction of the mag, because the creative director, of course, Robin Derrick, was a long-time sort of Vogue figure. Now, do you think that was quite a sort of, you know, a contrived decision to say, you know, we need to get at that sort of, you know, that incredible Rolodex and that particular sort of fashion sensibility? Was there a wariness, do you think, about being seen to be, you know, too close almost to that? Or is that something that's just, it was a necessary part of where the sort of overall direction of where the magazine was going to go?
I think Robin's appointment was a very considered decision. We were looking for someone who had a lot of history in print magazines and, you know, a ton of experience, and also someone that was very involved in the digital aspects. And had launched apps and worked on digital editions before. And with working through Spring Creative, which is a digital creative agency, we were able to marry the two, you know, the two disciplines, so editorial and digital. And I think Robin's one of the few sort of creative directors working in the industry that has, you know, a huge amount of experience in both those areas.
And let's talk just about the sort of overall experience, because I'm always interested in that sort of newsstand impact and the first impression that you get, you know, from the covers even of magazines. How conscious were you and the rest of the team when you were all looking at this of being, I guess, what's the word, balancing being, you know, fairly conservative with a small c and not taking too many risks because of the sheer scale of the project, but also being mindful that this was a completely new project and completely new possibilities? How did you sort of weigh up those elements and arrive at that, the sort of the overall look and feel of the title?
I think at the forefront of our minds was creating a woman and not a magazine. When we talk about Porter, we talk about her and we don't talk about it as an it. So we always have the woman at the forefront of our minds, and we want to bring, you know, the woman to the forefront of all the fashion photography. So even though it's very, you know, fashion forward, we don't want the clothes to, you know, the woman, the clothes to wear the woman rather than the woman wearing the clothes. And we also wanted to create a new language in terms of, you know, how the female is presented in fashion photography. I think there's been a lot of sort of debate about how to create this new language of strength and sensuality, because I think for a long time, women have been represented as these kind of arched Helmut Newton sex kittens. And, you know, we're all about being sensual, but we want to, you know, redefine what that means. So with the photographers Inez and Venud, who are shooting all our covers, we discussed how do we present that image in a modern world? We want the woman to be able to be fragile but still be strong, to be able to be intelligent but still be fashionable. And so that's what we've really worked on creating with them. And that's why when you see, we had Giselle, Brazilian supermodel Giselle Bündchen on the first cover, we literally stripped her back. She's always portrayed as this, like, you know, high heels, bikini, arch-back, you know, Victoria's Secret style beauty. And we just wanted to strip her back and photograph her in a very intimate way. The same with Lady Gaga for this issue. We, you know, we spoke to her management and her team. We said, look, we don't want theatrics. We want to show Lady Gaga as she is, the woman that she is behind the mask. And she allowed us to do that. So I think for us moving forward, the way we portray women is always in an intimate way, in an intelligent way. And we don't ever want to, you know, present an unrealistic ideal.
And we'll be talking a bit more about those covers and the photography, the fashion photography, and a whole lot more besides as we continue to talk with Gabrielle Hackworthy right after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, I'm delighted to say. She hasn't gone anywhere yet. It's Gabrielle Hackworthy, fashion director at Porter Magazine. Gabrielle, before the break, we were talking a little bit about your cover stars. Giselle Bündchen, you mentioned, of course, in the spring volume. Summer is before us here with Gaga. As you said, these much more kind of stripped back. It will probably take some people by surprise to see a more, well, as you say, a less theatrical side, perhaps. Talk to us a little bit about the driving forces, the factors behind these images then, because you've had Giselle, as you say, Gaga. Are you just working your way through the G's, or is there another? What's the strategy when you pick these the kinds of women that you're looking to feature?
Well, each issue is themed. So our first issue, the theme was strength and sensuality, and we felt like Giselle was, you know, the perfect woman to represent those elements. And then this issue that's out now, our summer issue, this theme is storytelling. So we wanted to have, you know, a storyteller on the issue, which I think Lady Gaga is probably the penultimate. And then once we've decided on the theme, then we cast the characters. And you'll see throughout the magazine, every section will have different storytellers. So even within the fashion well, we have an actress, Abby Cornish, who's a young Australian actress playing a young Norman Jean Roy. We have supermodel Karen Elson playing a pre-Raphaelite sort of heroine to tie in with the pre-Raphaelite exhibition that's happening at the moment. So we like to add another layer to all the fashion stories. And with Gaga, we wanted to represent, you know, all those. And from a fashion point of view, we took inspiration from all those sort of 70s amazing songwriters like Stevie Nicks and Joni Mitchell. And we wanted to do a really sort of more retro inspired idea with her. So it's never fashion represented on one level. There's always a story behind the fashion idea, and we just like to add layers, and it just adds a level of intelligence to the way we represent fashion.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a bit more about that, marrying up those ideas and especially that storytelling thing, because it's clearly unafraid of telling stories and, you know, committing words to the page. You know, we sometimes see magazines that are almost word-free zones. Is that because you have this understanding, do you think, of your reader in a much more acute way, and you know the kinds of narratives they're interested in, both in terms of the images they see, but the stories that are told through the images and also are told in the words on the page itself?
I think we always strive to, you know, bring an intelligence to the photography, and Lucy Yeomans, the editor-in-chief, is, you know, so passionate about words. So for her, the words are as important as the images themselves. And if we can add to a fashion story by asking an amazing writer to, you know, add some words to the piece, for us it's just a better experience for the reader. We did a big trip to Morocco, so we have writers giving quotes on, you know, their experiences in Morocco. So it's always bringing in lots of voices into the magazine and not just one voice, and just bringing in women and writers and artists and celebrities who we really admire and getting their voices into the magazine.
One or two voices have been perhaps a little wary because it's a competition from a source perhaps that they weren't expecting, and some sort of backhanded compliments. One or two things people suggesting that it's almost got a consumer-y feel. I mean, that must rile you up a great deal. Thinking of some of the voices from Vogue, for example, who knows, maybe they're a bit edgy about what this represents. But if you get that kind of comment, what did that mean? Are you concerned by that, or do you think, hey, you know, if people are worrying, that's actually good news?
I think, you know, that those sorts of comments we take as, you know, a degree of flattery, because if they're very worried about us, then, you know, we're doing a great job. We've never put ourselves in competition with anything on the newsstand because we feel like we're a completely unique product. We're offering something different to what everyone else is doing. We're global. We're every 2 months. So, yes, we're a luxury magazine, but I think the offering is completely different to what exists.
And is there a sort of an enjoyable sense then of being a bit of a kind of almost like a gatecrasher on that scene? Is that an unfair characterization, or is that kind of fun? You know, actually mixing up a pretty kind of established environment.
I think we're definitely the cool kids on the block. We had a launch party in Paris, and everyone was there, including Rihanna, who we had to ask to leave at 4 a.m. because she was having such a good time, and it was definitely the party of the season. So everyone's looking to Porter.
This idea of being the kind of the, you know, the new kid on the block, it is pretty, I guess it's pretty liberating as well, both, you know, editorially, commercially, because, you know, you can function without too many parameters. You can kind of go where the sort of interest and where your creative passions take you.
Yeah, I think there haven't been any sort of major developments in women's luxury fashion magazines for so many years. Not since, I don't know, colour photography. We're still doing the same thing that we've always done. And I don't think the industry is ready for change, but I don't think everyone in the industry likes change. But the world is changing, and we're just, you know, pioneering a new way of speaking to readers and women across the globe by offering them, you know, amazing editorial content, but also by offering them a shopping platform as well. And I don't think that should be a dirty word, because essentially you don't need to read a fashion magazine to know what's in fashion. You need to give your readers some sort of service. And I think that's what's lacking in so many of the titles that exist today. It's like you can look at a page in a magazine and think, I love that dress. That's amazing. That dress, I need to own that dress. But you can't actually buy that dress. So if we can kind of help service our readers in some way to help them get that dress in, you know, the easiest way they can, then I think that's just, you know, that's a good thing. I don't think it's a dirty word to service your readers.
Gabriel, it's always great to speak with you. I just wonder, the figures are kind of astonishing, and 60 countries and growing, this kind of thing. What else do we have to look forward to? I mean, in the coming weeks and months, obviously you can't give away all your trade secrets for the next few instalments, with the summer one still barely, you know, fresh off the presses. But What's the most exciting things as you look ahead, even, you know, 6 months, maybe a year ahead? What are the kind of things that you're focusing in on now?
I think now that we're into the magazine and it's established, we're going to be looking at developing the digital edition a lot more, because we have focused on print for the launch, and there's so much to do on the digital edition in terms of video and interaction with our users. So that's what we'll be focusing on. And also, you know, just growing the magazine and getting better. And we're really listening to the readers' feedback a lot and taking it all on board. And we want to give women what they want. So we don't produce this magazine just for the industry or just for our friends. It's like we're really listening to the women who we want to speak to.
Giving the people what they want. So we should watch this space, I think, is what you're telling me.
Yes. Lots
more excitement ahead. Gabrielle Hackworthy, fashion director of Porter magazine, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Stack, and do promise to come and see us again and tell us about the exciting developments as they continue to happen in the months and years ahead.
Thank you. I will do.
Now, as internationally minded as The Stack is, searching the shelves of Chicago and presses of Poland to bring the latest in independent publishing trends, this time we haven't had to look so far to bring you a story that will surely warm the hearts of our print-obsessed listeners. Earlier this week, friend of The Stack and regular guest Stephen Watson went up to Nottingham in England's East Midlands to meet Alex Smith, the man behind the brand new Ideas on Paper magazine shop. Having had enough of the state of the high street's fairly paltry choice of independent magazine offerings, Alex thought he would go it alone and set up shop in the city's creative quarter.
One of the biggest problems facing the UK's independent magazines is the lack of independent retailers. It doesn't make sense for these small magazines to fight it out on the shelves of Smith's for sale or return, so they need an alternative. That's why I've come to Cobden Chambers in Nottingham's creative quarter to meet a man bringing independent publishing to the East Midlands. Alex Smith, founder of Ideas on Paper, a new independent magazine shop opening in the city.
I've always been excited by print. I grew up in quite an academic family, quite bookish, and I've always been surrounded and loved by and loved books. But at the same time, my personal reading habits tend to be quite skittish, so I often flick through things and put them down and move on to something else. And magazines just proved to be the perfect vehicle for that. And recently, with the boom in independent publishing, I've just found so much exciting material to read, and not only long-form journalism, but also you can find great visual content, great illustration, and just really, really exciting things to look at. And so that really marries my family's background with my personal reading habits.
At Ideas on Paper, everything from the careful selection of magazines looking down from the walls to the hand-ground coffee speaks of a desire to do things differently.
I think you've got to offer a compelling experience to customers if you're going to expect them to part with their money in a bricks and mortar store. You can't just sit behind the counter and take their business for granted. So the key thing is to create an environment that they want to spend time in and start to build a community that they want to be a part of. So when customers come in here, I'll make them a coffee. They can hear the music being played, which is also for sale. I've got prints on the wall, as well as the magazines. I've got books for sale. I'm doing good trade in Gestalten's books, and a lot of stationery sales in the first week as well. People are loving the School of Life products.
And looking around us here, I mean, you've got everything from kind of the space, everything is very tastefully done, very, very carefully selected and arranged. What's your take on the current magazine high street?
I think it's absolutely dreadful. I describe going into any one of the multiple high street chains as hold your breath, duck your head down, run in, grab what you want and get out. It's not an exciting experience at all. And you don't feel inclined to linger in that kind of space. So they're not maximising the opportunity that they have with the customers that visit, because people will likely pick up the title they know they want and escape again.
You can't help but feel that you're a start of something new here. There's builders hammering away on the rooftops opposite, and it feels like not just Ideas on Paper, but this whole area of Nottingham is starting something new, is building on a creative approach to the world.
You're absolutely right about the work that's going on here, because there's a lot of regeneration taking place, which is fueled by this desire for people to open their own stores. And, well, Ideas on Paper covers a selection of magazines, journals, books and stationery. It's important for me to have the mix, because if you narrow yourself down too much, then that makes life harder. So it's key to have a good range of products. And I'm finding that I'm selling all the product categories across the board, even within the first week. So people are coming in and they're buying a couple of magazines, a book, something to jot their ideas down on, and they're even liking the music that's being played. So they're buying a CD, they're having a coffee, so it's a complete experience. And I'm turning an £8 magazine sale into a £30 average transaction, so I'm really happy with that.
With customers drawn by Alex's killer combination of coffee and magazines, the future looks bright for Ideas on Paper. Reporting from Nottingham, I'm Stephen Watson.
That was Stephen Watson of independent magazine distributors Stack.com, bringing us that report from Nottingham here in England. And that brings us to the end of this 86th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards, here on Monocle 24. A special thanks, of course, to my guest, Gabrielle Hackworthy of Porter Magazine. Our producer was David Pleasant, behind the glass here at Midori House. Our studio manager, Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note. We're at info@monocle.com. And remember, we'll be back next Saturday at the very same time. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brule, will be back in the chair. Of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, until next time, it's goodbye.